J.J. Albert is the Swiss Army knife of lacrosse. He's the sport's Dos Equis most interesting man in the world. When most kids were playing kick the can in the neighborhood, Jay was crisscrossing the globe. He was on World Cup ski slopes filming action sports with his father long before action sports was even a catchphrase. Jay was the leader on that groundbreaking Virginia lacrosse team that gave Dom Starzia his first championship after all those years of near misses. Major League Lacrosse arrived just as Jay was graduating. That version of the sport, that gopher broke version of lacrosse, fit his style of play perfectly. In 2003, he was the MLL MVP, and he was also one of the marketing faces of the league. At the Philly Wings, when they won their NLL championship, they called Jay the janitor. He was the rookie. He was scrappy. He would do the dirty work. And he's also the guy who popularized the now ever-present swim dodge or swim move. He was one of the first prominent lacrosse players who was forced to retire because of concussions, just as concussion awareness was taking hold. On top of all this, Jay is the co-founder of Maverick Lacrosse. J.J. Albert was a snow, surf, and skate punk who decided to pick up a lacrosse stick. Now, he's in the Hall of Fame. Jay.
What's up, man?
I love it. I loved researching you because you have so much material on YouTube. Skiing makes you really unique, and I think it tied into your lacrosse skills to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
The way people talk about their favorite athletes tells a lot about how they sort of think about being an athlete.
Yeah.
I want to know who your favorite skier is.
Yeah, sure. My favorite skier, well, I guess the first one would be my father. I mean, he's a phenomenal skier and still is, but growing up, he was, you know, I was on skis when I was two, so it was kind of always looking up to him. But we were around, because of the family business, we were around ski racing a lot. I was around it my whole life. Some amazing skiers over the years. Alberto Tombo was one of the young, when I was younger, I definitely admired him. As I got older and more into the business, you know, I got to know and became friends with Bodie Miller aside from, you know, becoming friends with him off the hill, obviously was, you know, admired what he did on the hill. There was similarities in our personalities, which is maybe why we became friends, but he just laid it all on the line. I mean, he first started out doing a lot of slalom skiing, and it was a buck and bronco ride, as they described it. The press described it many times. He was all over the place and, you know, would either be out of the course and ski and finish last or be first. And that was kind of like his attitude. And it was cool and people loved it. I enjoyed covering it.
A lot of skiing is about flair, and your personality is on full display when you're developing a skiing style. When you stepped onto the lacrosse field, was it a conscious decision that you were going to play with a certain edge, a certain style?
It did. You know, the style I liked was playing hard, right? So, you know, I think playing aggressive and playing hard and taking chances. And I think that goes back to, again, you know, some of the athletes that I looked up to growing up. But, I mean, that was what I liked about sports was taking chances, you know, even looking now at golf and I enjoy playing golf now, believe it or not, but watching some of Arnold Palmer and Phil Mickelson and some of their shots, they were aggressive. They were never conservative. And that was my style. I don't know if it was necessarily conscious. I certainly, you know, wanted to go to Virginia and I liked that style of play and it was aggressive and, you know, it was all or nothing. And watching the guys like Michael Watson and Doug Knight, you know, when I was looking at schools, I was like, I want to go there. I want to play there. So there is a flair there. There is, you know, something exciting for people. What was, you know, even further below that than kind of pleasing everybody was just, you know, being aggressive.
I found your dad's Hall of Fame video, and it mm-hmm. is classic. I encourage everyone to go to Jailbear Productions and watch this video. He was skiing for Robert Redford. He was doing stunt double for Robert Redford. Picked up a camera. He loved it. Next thing you know, he's getting awards with a handlebar mustache. You grew up in that world with him as your old man. You were carrying battery packs to and from the cameraman on the side of the hill. Was that as charmed a life as it looked, or was it like a grind and a lot of hard work?
No, for me, it was amazing. I loved it. I know now, because I actually do that now for my living, I know it is hard work. It was cool for me. It was great. And we, you know, as a family, you know, he took us everywhere. So my mom was packing us around all the world. I mean, I remember when I was in first grade, I missed like, I don't know, some crazy, you know, 40 days of school because I was in Europe going from the Hahnenkamm to Wengen to Val Gardena to Val d'Isère and all these World Cup races. You know, that was an education, you know, which is a separate conversation, but that was, you learn a lot there too as well. So I would never exchange that. But I say to people now, I'm not like a great skier. I'm not pretty, but you know, I'm a strong skier because I used to, you know, my dad, you know, as soon as I was old enough, I would be carrying tripods or that sort of thing. And I'd have credentials and I'd be on a World Cup, you know, race hill, you know, helping his guys do whatever. And it was a lot of fun, but you know, it was definitely work, you know, but you know, I think it was definitely something that, you know, I think looking back on it as I'm older now, like, you know, molded me into sort of the person I grew up to be, is because there's a lot of traveling. You have to improvise and make decisions, you know, on the run. It's not just, you know, wake up and every day and do the same thing. You're just kind of doing different stuff. And a lot of it is physical and a lot of it's hard and cold, and you have to get by however you can. If you can't speak German, you got to pretend like you do to try to get into a certain place. So it was a lot of fun.
You were a two-time high school All-American. Just mm-hmm. like off the hip, what does that window of time mean to you?
You know, that to me, that's like, that was just like the stepping stone. I was ready. You know, I think I knew I had what it, I wanted to prove at that point, in high school, junior and senior year, All-American, I was ready to prove that I could play with anyone in the world. That's what it meant to me.
I picture you in high school as just sort of a cocky maniac.
I would probably say, yeah, that's probably pretty accurate. Yeah.
Describe your sort of attitude. Cause, and the reason I say it is like, how could you not be when you're flying off to ski in all these different places and hanging out with all these celebrities and then coming back to your high school in Long Island? How could you not walk around with like a strut, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think it was, confidence would come from like, you know, being able to like, you know, actually do something, you know, to give you confidence. You know, in our high school, I think there was, I would say maybe a little bit of a chip on our shoulder, on my shoulder, but it was mainly because, you know, we were a small high school and we weren't, you know, we would usually get, you know, beat by most of the bigger schools, the Garden Cities, and I thought we could play with anyone and I could play with anyone. So there was a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, I guess, you know, in the high school ranks.
What were you like in high school? What kind of music did you listen to?
You know, fifth grade, I got a snowboard, right? And snowboard was just coming up and I was like, wow, this is amazing. So my dad reluctantly got me a snowboard and that was it. I didn't ski for 15 years, I don't think. So I snowboarded all throughout high school. I skateboarded. I, you know, we did a ton of wakeboarding, you know, got a little BMX stint. So very much, you know, those sort of sports. Junior year, I got my first surfboard. So junior and senior year, I did a bunch of surfing as well. So then that was kind of what I did and what I loved. I guess I dressed like that. I had long hair. You know, I think I, you know, had a good time. I was, I guess, a little bit, I don't want to say like reckless, but I had, you know, I had a lot of energy and to it. And then I guess lacrosse was introduced to me fifth grade. I think my brother gave me a stick and, you know, it was obviously, you know, big here, but I really started to like lacrosse when I got to, I think, seventh or eighth grade. Once I got into junior high is when, you know, we were playing and I started practicing and I was like, you know, this is an awesome sport. You know, my brother had gone to Virginia and I was kind of like around it a lot. So, you know, right around eighth grade playing JV, you know, I had some people in my high school. Coach Jim Frank was, you know, our head varsity coach. And I remember just him grabbing me and being like, you know, you're pretty good. You know, you could go to college.
And lacrosse fits for a kid like you were, right? Because it's a it's kind of a counterculture sport in some towns. It certainly was where I grew up. We would all go down behind the school working on shots and stuff like that. That kind of after school camaraderie that you're talking about really meshes with like the X Games sort of free thinking, freewheeling attitude.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, you know, I've been saying this for a while. I think, you know, the connection really is for me is like the stick, right? So the stick was always like something you had with you all the time. You were always messing around with it, fiddling with it, perfecting it, tinkering. And that's really similar to like, you know, a skateboarding, for instance, where like, you know, you've got this tool and it's, you know, you can make it look however you want. You can make it there's no rules. Definitely one of those kids that when the lacrosse stick was always with me and I was always messing around with it. If you talk to my mom, I would just carry it around with me in the house and like go outside and throw it against the wall, come back inside, mess with it, go outside and shoot, come back in, go out when it was dark out, play with the stick, messing around with it, pulling leathers, you know, literally, you know, looking back almost like obsessive compulsive. And it was also, you can make it look however you want. You tape it up, you do it, you know, this, you put colored tape on it. You can do dyes. I remember when Curl Across Unlimited came out and they started dyeing sticks, I'd be like, oh my God, this is amazing. It's a little bit of like this expression piece, and it's like an extension of you and your personality. And that was definitely something I found as a similarity. And, you know, when we started Maverick, I was like, that was kind of a little bit of the backbone of what our message was and what what we wanted to do with the company was, making sure that we, you know, the stick and whatever it is we created could be something different and something kind of cool and interesting and something you could make your own. So
having the little chip on your shoulder because you're the little guy playing against Manhasset and Garden City, did going to Cold Spring Harbor, do you think, help your career when you showed up at Virginia?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. And looking back on it now, that was a big piece of my motivation was, you know, trying to, you know, wanting to prove yourself. And I would say another thing that happened, I think, is something that I would contribute to me being hungry, you know, going into college, was not making the under-19 teams. And, I went to the tryouts I actually played great. You know, I thought I did, and I thought I earned my way onto the team, but I didn't make it. And I just remember that just lighting a fire under me because I thought for sure I was good enough to be on that team. And going into Virginia, I think we had like 6 or 7 or even 8 guys that were on that team that made the team.
So I'm curious about this dynamic of your brother being at Virginia. You know, in terms of you getting recruited, did you look at a bunch of schools?
I wouldn't say it was a foregone conclusion when my brother was at Virginia that I would go there. He's 10 years older than me, and so, you know, when he was there, I was pretty young. But as I got older, the point I knew I wanted to go to Virginia and nowhere else, even though I took all 4 or 5 or whatever recruiting trips, I back my mind, I knew Virginia. It was one when Dom went there. And then, you know, I thought that was kind of a good stepping stone. But the real moment was I went to the Final Four, I think it was 94, I want to say, in Bird Stadium. I was sitting
the Syracuse game.
Syracuse, Virginia semifinals.
Unreal.
Was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And that's actually, you know, not only going to Virginia, but that's what like literally was like, this is, you know, one of the coolest sports ever. I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, Michael Watson was, you know, doing his thing. And even on the other side, Rick Beardsley throwing like, you know, 50 yard behind the back passes to guys on the run. And
we were late to that game and driving up. So we had to park in the furthest spot away from the stadium, and the roar of the crowd, it was like, you know, here in Baltimore during a Ravens game, I can hear the roar of the crowd all the way across the city.
It was amazing. And you know, the display that Michael Watson put on was just, you know, it was no other word to describe him than inspirational. I mean, he was a freshman and he had like, you know, absolutely no fear whatsoever. It was just going at, you know, Rick Beardsley and scored, you know, several goals, and the one diving goal I'll never forget, we dove across and scored. He came underneath and kind of dove across the goal. I mean, it was amazing. And you know, just the style they played too. I mean, I think, you know, Tony Nugent threw like a rusty gate at some point, and the defense was throwing over the heads and butt digs, and it was an up and down. That was just a great game to watch. And I would say, you asked earlier about where the sport is going. I think that's where the sport needs to go back to, because that's amazing. And I think, you know, I guess, you know, we can talk about the shot clock if you'd like to, but I think that would be pretty cool. And it would push the sport towards more of that direction, because that was just one of the most exciting things I've ever seen. That made me want to go to Virginia. I can talk about Dom as well. And then obviously the recruiting process happened and you know, he was looking at, you know, a lot of the schools, Syracuse and Hopkins and North Carolina and Georgetown I was looking at. But I kind of knew I wanted to go to Virginia, and then, you know, Dom came to dinner at my house, and that was, you know, definitely just the icing on the cake. Obviously, my parents loved him, and Dom's just a, you know, fantastic, phenomenal human being. So it was kind of an easy decision for me.
The newsprint version of the magazine in one of the first issues, your freshman year, I think it was the Hopkins. It was definitely the Hopkins Virginia game. It was this sort of classic photo of you diving or sort of falling and shooting. Talk about Michael Watson being fearless. You show up at Virginia as a freshman and you have a big game, the Virginia Syracuse, the famous Virginia Syracuse game. How did you overcome what so many freshmen cannot?
That's a good question. I think you get to college and you start practicing and you know, you just, I just, you know, I just felt like I could, again, it was maybe a little bit of a character flaw, but, you know, I maybe just was overconfident and just felt like I could compete, you know, with anyone. So, I remember that game specifically. I mean, I think I was running second midfield, and I just remember it was the first game and no one really knew or heard of me and I was getting a short stick. So I hadn't gotten a short stick since, you know, I get a long time. So that was, I remember just being like, oh, okay, this, and the Syracuse at the time, you know, there wasn't much of a sliding package. So I remember going through my mind, like, no one's even look. I'm dodging a short stick and no one's even, you know, behind there looking at me like this is, I dodge and beat the guy and no one came to me. I'm like, this is, you know, crazy. I just remember being like, wow, this is amazing. And I, you know, I kept going on the field and I kept not getting short sticks and there'd never be a slide coming and, you know, kept shooting and had, you know, three or four goals, I think, four goals. And, you know, I actually had a couple pipes too at the end of the game.
Was there a moment like you've got Michael Watson, Doug Knight, who are famous for diving to the cage, and you had seen them, you had admired them, and you had a pretty similar style that you were bringing. Did they see that in you and like take you under the wings? Were you like their favorite player? Like, did Dom like endorse that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it, like I said, as soon as I got to Virginia, it was like one big family, you know, and I'd have to say like Drew McKnight might've been, you know, my, it was my year and, you know, one of my closest friends is he was probably even diving more than I was and he was playing attack. So it was Drew behind the goal and then Michael Watson and then Doug Knight. So, I mean, he was, you know, I think it was encouraged, you know, I think Dom, you know, tried to let us, you know, do what we wanted to do. And I think early on in practice, I remember I was diving a lot. There was a lot of diving going on everywhere. You know, looking back, it was probably pretty funny. But, you know, Dougie, on the other hand, though, but he didn't dive a ton in practice, you know, like it was like, you know, he kind of like it was. I remember early on just being like, you know, because I watched him play and I was like, I remember the next year, his junior year, I think he had like 8 or 9 goals against Syracuse at a game I'd watched. I knew I was going to Virginia at that point. It was my senior year. And I was like, and they were like bounce passes. And I'm like, this guy is a freak. I'm like, this guy's amazing. And then I got to Virginia and his senior year, he kind of like saved himself a little bit in fall ball. I was like, oh, I want to see him dive, you know? And then as soon as the first game happened, he was like all over the place again.
He was all over the place. I don't know if there's ever been a guy like him before or ever will be.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
You know, the swim dodge, as it's kind of become famous for mm-hmm. now. It seems like you were doing that dodge or a version of that dodge when you were in high school. Then you go to Virginia, where a lot of people are doing these dives. When you are skiing, when you're launching yourself off a jump, you cannot hesitate. It's all or nothing, or you're going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of that when you know, turn a corner or decide to go into the defense and cut through and try and score a goal. How much of the skiing tied into your mentality that you were bringing to the lacrosse field in that regard?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, right? It's kind of like a commitment to it, a fearlessness. So I guess kind of two things, like you commit to it because you're fearless, right? So you have to be a little bit, you know, unscared or confident you won't get hurt, right? So if you've had a long history of getting hurt every time you do things growing up, you're probably going to be a little more hesitant to do things. So I think that is, you know, kind of a piece of it. And then, you know, being fearless and being okay with the potential outcomes or the worst case scenario gives you the ability to commit. Like if you try to do a backflip on a snowboard and you like just kind of like halfway do it, it's like the worst possible thing. you know, there's not a lot of time to really contemplate or think about it. I think it's more of like just a reaction sort of thing.
The swim move, it seems like you've got kind of a spider sense. This guy's coming at me. I'm going to give him a little fake here. I'm going to dip the stick up over his head, go to the other direction.
The swim move I started doing in high school, and it was like, I think guys get really close to you. It is kind of like a spatial awareness thing. I mean, the way I would always kind of use, there's two ways to use it. And you know, at the camps and stuff, I would teach it is one is like an olay more to sort of move, like, you know, like olay, you kind of, when a guy's trying to hit you, you make it seem like you don't know he's there, right? So you try to like look the other way, pretend you want him to think he's like gonna lay you out, right? And have the biggest hit on you ever, and then right at the last minute you kind of let him go right underneath. So as you're kind of running, you kind of see him out of your corner of your eye. So it's more of like a peripheral vision sort of situation where you. And that's the same thing with dodging. And like you mentioned earlier, dodging and seeing the double teams. I mean, most of the time when I was dodging throughout my entire career, I was rarely looking at the defender, you know, covering me. I'd usually have confidence I could, you know, beat him one-on-one if I had to. It was really seeing what was happening beyond that and then, you know, kind of making decisions from there. But, you know, for the swim move, you know, that the olay was you just kind of, you know, you wanted him to be the one doing most of the work and you're just kind of getting out of the way. And you kind of, you keep your stick out there because that's, you know, that's part of what he's trying to hit, right? So, and then you kind of let him go underneath your stick. The other one is kind of pulling it over as part of your dodge. So if you're going at a defender, is pulling the swim over, either over his head or a lot of times it's over the stick of the defender. If he's got a stick in your belly and you send him, he's trying to keep you there. If you send him one way with your kind of your inflection and your stick and he goes that way, but your body's going to start going the other way first, and then you kind of have your stick kind of fly over them.
The thing that amazes me is you're describing it like, let this like angry running bull come at you and sidestep him.
Yeah.
But like, that takes incredible athleticism. But I'm just saying, like, cardiovascular, like when you're running a midfield line or you're playing attack, mm-hmm. your lungs are pumping like you're on top of Mount Everest, you know, like it's really tough to have the presence of mind to sidestep someone and do a move that sort of finessed, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think that move is kind of played out? Like you hit it in its heyday.
It's a timeless. I think the Olay version of the swim move is timeless because, you know, I think, and it's not, you're not exerting that much. You don't have to be. It's almost like, in a lot of ways, it's almost like a cop out, right? I mean, they're doing most of the work. They're like, I'm gonna, you know, exert all my energy to take this guy out.
It's like Tai Chi. You know, use your balance and let the
exactly. It's more of just kind of like, again, you got to. It's more of like a sell. You got to sell them that you don't see them, right? And they have to be convinced that they're gonna hit you until the last moment when you move out of the way, and you kind of let them go underneath you. So it's more of like a, you know, kind of a spatial awareness, peripheral vision sort of thing. There's probably been more times than not when someone thinks they're gonna line me up and hit me, and I don't see them, and they do hit me. So I mean, that happens a lot too. So it's a good looking move, I guess, for people. So I think it got a lot of attention. Whereas, you know, a number of times when someone looks like they're going to hit you, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, he's going to get laid out," and then, "Oh wait, there he goes," and then you're kind of, you know, you're right past him, and it's effective too. It really was. I mean, not only it's not just like something that looks cool; it gives you a significant advantage because that person's now like, you know, after they try to hit you, they're like 5 yards behind you now. So it was an effective move, and I still think it is today.
I don't think people realize how crazy like the media got about Dom not winning a championship. Do you remember Dom was at Virginia long enough? And let's give him a break. The real story was the domination of Syracuse and of Princeton. They were winning everything. Virginia was really good, but people were talking about how Dom couldn't get the monkey off his back. Leading up to that championship, how much was that like, were you even thinking about that type of pressure?
No, I mean, it was, it was talked about. I mean, I remember my freshman class. We had conversations about it, talked about it. You know, Syracuse and Princeton had kind of won all the ones previous, but I mean, gosh, it was so a bounce of the ball one way or the other in the years prior for Dom and the Virginia teams, and it would have been his. So it was so very close, and I think because it was so very close, that is why there was kind of more pressure than if he had going into that season. I remember the year before, my sophomore year, we'd lost to Syracuse at Hofstra, and I remember being in the locker room, and I remember Drew McKnight, my teammate, he was next to me, and he was like, this is crazy, I didn't come here to, lose in the quarterfinals, and he was exactly right. I think the next year coming in, I think there was a different mindset on the team. I think from the coaching down, I think, to the captains, to the players, it was like, we need to be more serious about this, and, Don talks about it openly, and about the drinking rule he'd implemented that year, and it was a big deal. I mean, I came to Virginia, and we obviously like to have fun. The team liked to have fun. I think back in the day, that was more the norm. I think going out and having fun was just part of lacrosse.
You stood up in the locker room, right? You're like, listen, if I'm not drinking, none of you clowns are drinking, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely happened. It was more of me because I was against the rule, to be honest with you. I was like, I remember being like, we don't need to do this. We can still be serious, but we had the drinking policies. We can only drink on Saturdays after games. But, most of the team voted, let's do it. I mean, and I remember, I guess the story, the story's right, but I think it was me being like, all right, well, if we are going to do this and I'm not drinking during the week, I don't want to, I don't know. I don't want to find out other people are drinking and us not doing it. If we're going to do it, we got to do it. And it worked out. I really do think that it was important for the team. I think it just set a little bit more of a focus. I think our practices were better. And even more, I think, because it's all about what you do in the playoffs. I mean, we were so close and connected and focused. I think going into the games, it was like, can anyone beat us? That sort of thing. And there were some good teams that year. So,
there's a story about Richie Moran. Who knows how many filters this has gone through. But it was something like when he won one of his championships in the 70s, he like jumped up on a table and started dancing an Irish jig in front of everybody. What was Dom? I know Dom cut his mustache off, right? Like, what was his?
Yeah, that was it. We had a great tailgate, and we started celebrating in the tailgate there. And Dom promised to cut, his mustache off, and we did it right there. We have, there's photos of it. We had, right there in the parking lot in the tailgate outside Bird Stadium, the seniors all took turns shaving off pieces of his mustache, and he hasn't had it since.
All right, so let's hit on the NLL. I don't think you had much or any experience playing when you got to the Wings. I recall, just having a bunch of buddies on that team that you played with. You came in and you were just like the hardest working guy. You picked up every ground ball. In fact, they gave you some nickname like the sweeper or the vacuum cleaner or something like that.
The janitor.
Okay. there was such a culture in the Wings in Philly because they were a great team, but they were a great team that had a ton of Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. I got drafted by Philly. I'd probably say if I got drafted by anyone else, I may not have even played. I mean, I might have given it a go, but there were a lot of Americans on the team. I knew Jamie Hanford and Dan Radebaugh and Stilly and all these, Mark Millen on the team. There was, a good handful of Americans. And I remember, Hanford, since then I've become, one of my close friends, but he was like, oh, you're definitely playing, And early on, I realized that it was going to be hard for me to score. Like, I couldn't really figure that out. So I was like, all right, well, if I'm going to make this team and, try to make my way onto the team and make my way onto the field, I need to do other things. So I was like, I just need to, figure a way to get on the team. So I played hard. I got ground balls. I hit people.
Did you try and figure out the indoor game, or did you just go out and say, I'll just try and do what I do and hope that it fits?
It wasn't until I got got to the Mammoth where I was like, all right, I need to like learn the game. So for the Wings, I was a spark plug. I came off the bench again. Tried to stir it up, get ground balls, be aggressive on defense. And that was kind of my goal. We had a phenomenal team. I mean, we had Tom Marichek was our goal scorer, Jake Berge. I mean, legends that were running the offense, and Mark Millen and Tommy Ryan, and we won. It was amazing. We won the whole thing. It was phenomenal. We were a lower seed in the playoffs, and we went up to Toronto, which was the number one seed, defending champions. I think there was like 20,000 fans, standing room only, and I think we shocked them a little bit. We had Mark Millen had a great game, and Tommy and Jake, and we scored goals, and just kind of stole it, I guess.
How great was it to play with Tom Ryan? People see the dreadlocks, see him off the field, he's like really passive and nice, but on the field he's intense.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, TR was, he's one of those guys that when I post college, that was somewhat of an inspiration to me as far as like, how he would play the game, and when you step on the field, just give everything you got, right? So that you're exhausted at the end of the game. He was a completely chill guy off the field. One of the nicest guys I've ever come across with in the sport. And then not only did he play hard, but he was also nasty too. I mean, he was a guy you wanted on your team.
You talk about yourself in high school as having a little bit of a chip on your shoulder. You had something to prove in high school. And then, I watched your Hall of Fame acceptance speech, and you talk about your Virginia career where you said, I kind of came in as a punk kid and then I evolved to this sort of team leader. You get thrown in the locker room with Hanford and Stilley and all these guys, all very good friends of mine. And then you're back out on the field, and we got this article about you in Inside Lacrosse talking about how you are fierce and hated on the field because you talk so much smack. And I almost wonder if like that inner skateboarding punk got resurfaced when you stepped on the NLL field and started getting knocked around.
I absolutely 100% agree. I mean, it was almost like a restart, especially in indoor, because it was like, all right, well, it's lacrosse, but it's a different game. So, no one on any other team had any idea who I was, that's for sure. So, you kind of go back to, again, that little chip on your shoulder. It's also like, hey, man, how are we going to win this game, right? How can I be useful for the team? And, in high school, that was, going to the goal every time I got the ball, being the entire offense to, this situation where, I'm playing defense and, clearing the ball and coming off the field. And it was fun. It was actually, I look at the indoor game totally in my career playing indoor as like, it was a ton of fun because you're basically like just constantly learning. It was new every day. And as I got, went on to Colorado, I actually started to understand the game and really like it. And I actually think I became a somewhat decent indoor player by the time I stopped. But, you really were just learning new stuff every day.
Let's just talk about the advent of the MLL. You not only were involved as a top player out of the gates, like that game was your game. And on top of it, you got involved with Warrior doing some marketing. You were kind of put one of the faces of the league.
So my senior year at Virginia, we lost in the semifinals to Princeton. It was, heartbreaking. And I'm in the parking lot, at a tailgate, and Gabby Rowe comes up to me, and this is literally the first time I ever heard about it. And he's like, do you want to play in the MLL? I'm like, what's MLL? He's like, Major League Lacrosse. It's starting in 3 weeks. We're going to, we're starting these games and we're traveling around and we're doing these two teams. That was the showcase year, the first year. And I'm like, well, I'm going to Vegas next week. can I come after that? And he was like, yeah, no problem. Just whenever you want to do it. So, I ended up playing in that, and that was a ton of fun. It was great because early on they did it right. Jake and Dave Morrow, they put some money behind it and resources, and they tried to make it really professional. That league, once we started the next year in that league, it was definitely it really fit my style of game. Again, I played somewhat, free and for good or bad. It was, tempo and, aggressive and maybe sometimes not the smartest. But that league, that was what you needed to do, right? I mean, there was a shot clock, right? I mean, as soon as the goalie had a save, you had to get a shot off. So, I mean, you had to bring the ball up and, there's a green light at any point, right? I mean, if you saw an opportunity, whether it was if you just brought it over the midfield line and there was, you felt like dodging, you could dodge. So they let a lot of things slide. I mean, there was slashes were rarely called, and I would get slashed a lot. So in turn, I would slash people back. And you know, defensively, I think you could be more aggressive. You can go over the heads, and because it was just a little more of a melee versus the college game.
And you were playing for New Jersey. It was like a weird stadium. It wasn't like a typical field. Yeah. There were not big crowds at all. Not much fanfare, probably compared to the Showcase. But the lacrosse was ridiculously good.
It was awesome. I mean, I from the early stages of playing MLL, I just absolutely loved everything about it. I mean, the only thing that was, you know, somewhat of a bummer was, you know, we were playing in like a minor league baseball stadium, and there'd be, you know, 450 people there watching you play. But, you know, we didn't care. You know, it was like early on, it was like glorified summer ball. You played for, you know, pride, because all the best guys were there.
So where's your head at when you're coming out of Virginia? Were you planning on going into the family business?
Yeah, I mean, I was already working for NBC Sports. I'd done an internship in college in the summer for them, and then I was already set up to go to Sydney in the Olympics in September in 2000. So I'd already kind of knew I was getting into the, you know, sports television production world, and, you know, as a career. And I, you know, continued to kind of do stuff for NBC and ESPN, and then started working for my dad on the side, and you know, eventually over the course of, you know, the year, it kind of went full time and working for my dad and the family business. So
is that where you wanted to be? Like, is that where you saw yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, I had been doing the filmmaking, that sort of thing, like, you know, doing it and playing it in my mind for however long. I mean, since I was pretty young. But right after college, we, you know, the MLL happened, and then, you know, played a little NLL, and then I was working in the family business, filming ski racing and all these different other sports. So, you know, working and playing lacrosse.
What sent you to Long Island?
I didn't request it. It kind of made sense. Like, the MLL, like, back in the day, I don't know if it's still that way. I mean, there's, like, a lot of the trades happen, like, because, like, the alternative is, like, the guy not playing anymore, right?
Right.
You know, I didn't request it. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know it happened until I was over in Europe actually filming some stuff, and I got home, and I got a call from, I think it was Dito. And he said, "Hey, you're on the Lizards." I'm like, "Oh, cool, nice, awesome, yeah." You know, Lizards were, you know, I was working and I was living in the city, but I was working in Long Island, and obviously from Long Island, so I was certainly psyched, and obviously there was a great team.
Let's talk about how stacked that team was for a second. Just fly down through the credentials.
Lizards team was easily the greatest team I'd ever played on. I mean, so in goal, starting in goal, you had Brian Docherty, in my opinion, the greatest goalie ever. I mean, I didn't get to play with Sal or some of these other guys, but I mean, he was just, just from beginning, middle, and end, I mean, he was just awesome. An awesome teammate, too. I mean, very, very vocal. In defense, you had Gags, McCabe, and Volker. I mean, I don't know where to start there. So, I mean, you've got, McCabe was our captain, obviously one of the best defensemen ever to play. I mean, and you had Gags, who was, you know, obviously one of the best defensemen ever to play, takeaway guy, Gags was underrated, I felt, in like how aggressive he was. I mean, he, and nasty. I mean, Gags could be mean, and you know, our defense was, behind Doc was nasty, and then Volker, who I, you know, was older than I was, so I got to know Volker on the team, and just an amazing guy, unbelievable lacrosse mind, and just so solid. I mean, and again, another guy who was on defensive end that was mean and nasty. So it was a solid group back there. And then
to play in the MLL, do you need mean and nasty?
Back then you did, you know, to compete, because it was still kind of like 2003, those early years, it was still kind of a spillover from like the MAB and like the club, you know, whatever, right. The Green Turtle and like those days. So it was still those guys, and like it was mean. Like it was there was no love lost on the field. I mean, obviously after the game is a different story, but on the field it was, you know, people were dicks.
And they set it up. They almost kind of built it that way into the rivalries by switching people around and making this Long Island team very much a Long Island roster.
Absolutely, 100%, and especially against, you know, when we played against Baltimore. But yeah, I mean, and then the offense, we had, you know, a new guy that came over with me that year was Kevin Lowe, who was, you know, in my opinion, our MVP. I mean, he ran the offense. You know, he's not going to like stop the presses with anything that he does, but for, you know, internally within that locker room, I mean, he was the guy that kept our offense going, kept it settled. For me, a guy coming from midfield and dodging all the time, he really just, you know, was just a great tempo guy. He would let the tempo go when he felt, you know, he would let us run when he needed it, and then, you know, he'd kind of pull us back if we felt like we didn't need it. Who else was, obviously A.J. Hogan. We had Sombrato, Steven Sombrato, the man. I mean, the guys like Sombrato and Matt O'Kelly, and like, those are the guys I think that like, you know, were the difference maker, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, AJ and I could score a lot, but those are the guys that, you know, that I guess were the kind of a little bit of the heart and soul of the team.
So 2003 is probably your most decorated year. You're the ML, you win the championship, and you are the MVP of the entire league. Was that your pinnacle of when you were the best player?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I was 25. I was in great shape. I was playing a lot of lacrosse. I hadn't played indoor in a couple of years, but I'd already had the indoor year, so that makes you a better player. But yeah, I was on a great team. You know, there was like legends on our team. I mean, our coach was like John T. DeMasso, one of the best defensemen ever, and it was like he was the man. I mean, it was like he's one of the best coaches I played for. He just knew the right buttons to push for all the guys, which is kind of important in that league, right? I mean, it's not about X's and O's. It's about, you know, getting the best out of your guys, and he did that. And I used to love playing defense, like super aggressive. I'd start, as soon as a guy came over the midfield line, I would just start, you know, going after him and checking him and trying to get the ball. And you know, he would say, that's fine, you can do it, because if you get beat, at least you're getting beat up top, you know? I mean, and then we have time to slide. If you get beat, you know, further down into the defense, I mean, it just takes a little bit of time for the defender to get there, and you know, there's time in there for him to get a shot off or make a pass or whatever. You know, he would allow me to be aggressive, you know, in the middle of the field and take chances. If I could do that sort of thing all day, I would, and I did.
You're also starting to pop up in advertisements. Like, the classic ad is you, I think it's Hubbard, maybe Watson, on a beach out in like L.A.
Yep, yep.
What were you, like a warrior athlete or something?
Yeah. So I got, you know, going into the league, I became a part of the player, the Warriors Players Club. So I got accepted into the Warrior Players Club and got an endorsement deal. And yeah, they put us in ads. And, you know, those early years were fun. We had a good bunch of guys on that, two photo shoots a year, which were usually in nice places, and some fun times. But yeah, there were some classic advertisements with the blue steel look and that sort of thing.
But then 2003 hits, you're talking to John Gagliardi, and he wants you to become part of a new company, Maverick. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, we had, you know, I was with the Players Club, and my contract was coming up, so... you know, Gags and I were obviously teammates. We had talked about starting our own company, and he had kind of already started getting the ball going on that. And then, you know, once my contract was up, we started talking seriously. And I was like, yeah, I mean, no brainer for me. I mean, I think doing something like that. I mean, I wasn't exactly going to be able to buy a house with my endorsement deal with Warrior. So, it was something different. And what I liked about it was, you know, I like creating things. I mean, I like, you know, doing stuff and building things. And I saw this as a great opportunity because, you know, I've always been a creative guy, and John saw that in me as well as being a player, and he could see, you know, be someone helping with the marketing and, you know, the branding and all that sort of things.
Just as innovative as Warrior was with their print ads, in large part, print ads running through Inside Lacrosse, you guys were innovative with your videos a lot of times running through the Inside Lacrosse video player.
Yeah, so I had actually, for Warrior, I'd done a DVD called Exposure. So I'd pitched the idea to, you know, Warrior, and Hubbard and I created this DVD called Exposure. So that was like kind of my, you know, I think I was 25 when I did that, or 24. And that was kind of, you know, it was 24. It was my first foray into lacrosse production and utilizing my, you know, knowledge of the business to try to create something. The DVD was good. It was a good success, and I think, you know, people liked it. I think I guess, kind of saw as an opportunity to do that further down the road for Maverick. Our first video was like that reverse video where we were kind of like, it was kind of like a little web video that had a little bit of a viral reach from there. We just kept doing videos, you know, little segments and athlete bios, and then we did the, you know, the commercials and that sort of thing.
I can't remember like what I had for breakfast this morning, but I've got this steel trap for like obscure memories. Whose idea was it to bring Guitar Hero into the coaches convention?
I think that might have been my idea, because I was around that time I was big into Guitar Hero. I don't remember the exact thing, but I know at that time I was a top dog in Guitar Hero. So, you know, our booth wanted to be different than everyone else's. We were like, oh, we don't have a lot of money, but I can bring my Xbox. You know, maybe we can rent a TV and see how many people we can get over there. Our product might not be as good as everyone else, but damn it, we're having fun.
And didn't you guys pick up Rabel? Wasn't he the first, wasn't Maverick the first stop for Paul?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once we got 3 or 4 years into a little momentum, you know, I had stopped playing, and I think Gags had stopped playing. We were still kind of in the sport, but we were like, we need a new name, you know? And obviously Rabel was coming out, and he was it.
Did you ever think that he would like travel to where he is? Like, could you see like how good he was like in the marketing world?
Yeah, I absolutely. I think, you know, for me, you know, I saw that him as like the first stepping stone to lacrosse being a little bit different than it is now, like, and different in a good way, like professional. You know, he had an agent. You know, when I came out, it was like, yeah, you just talk to people and like, oh yeah, you want to be a warrior athlete? But like, sure, do you have any money to pay me? And it was like, you know, I don't even remember there being contracts. He came out and he had an agent, and we had to do everything through his agent. And it was, you know, it was kind of like, a couple times I was kind of like, well, why don't I just call Paul? We could probably figure this out. You know, he's a lacrosse player. We're all lacrosse players. Like, you know, there's no, but you know, you couldn't, because it was different. But it was great. We ended up working it out, and you know, Paul is Paul, and he was great for the company, and I think we helped him out in a lot of ways too. I think, you know, I think even if you asked him, he would say probably that first commercial we did with him was great for his brand. You know, we did that 106 mile per hour slow motion commercial, and that was our first one. And you know, once we signed him, we were like, you know, Gags was like, all right, we need to create a commercial, we need to leverage this, you know, this new relationship with Paul, is, you know, the biggest player coming out of college. And you know, I was like, well, what is, you know, he's got one of the fastest shots. You know, we had, as a business in Jalbert Productions, we had started working with the Phantom camera a little more. So it was like super slow motion, you know, 700, 800, 900 frames a second, you know, seeing baseballs move at that speed. So I was like, I saw that as an opportunity. It wasn't cheap, but I knew I could get a good deal. I could get a bro rate from one of the rental houses in Manhattan. And we did a one-day shoot with Paul and just captured amazing images. And it was visually stunning, and it caught people's eye. And I think it, you know, it had an impact.
Seems like you do best when you're pushed and when you've got something to be just a little bit pissed off about. Like, what's next? Like, does becoming a father just sort of suppress that?
My mindset isn't like that really anymore, I don't think. You know, once you get married and have kids, it's like for me anyway, it's like a completely different thought process. There's nothing, it's not about you or having a chip on your shoulder or anything else. Like 100% of my thoughts go to like, you know, your family. So it's almost like that was a different life, to be honest with you. Someone's like, oh, do you miss playing lacrosse? I'm like, I guess if I was back in there doing it and I was that person again, it would be, that was a lot of fun, but it almost feels like a different life ago. So I've picked up golf, which is, you know, a challenging for me. I mean, it's challenging in a different way. I mean, the hardest thing is like when you start playing bad, you can't like, you know, wrap the golf club around someone's back. So that was humbling.
All right. So Jay, you're one of the few people, or you were one of the first prominent people to literally have his career shut down. Like the concussion hit you pretty hard, right? What was the progression of getting that news? How scary was it? How seriously was it taken? Were you told you can't play anymore, or was it a decision that you made?
It was a decision I made for sure. It all kind of happened pretty quickly. I mean, I was playing indoor and, you know, just had a final year. We won, you know, I was they were kind of like, you probably shouldn't play in the championship game because I was getting hit in the head and concussions, and played in the championship game, I probably shouldn't have. Wasn't feeling well, I had to go to the hospital. It was still really, really early in the concussion, like, awareness. It wasn't, I mean, I went to a neurologist and they were like, well, your mom had migraines. Maybe, you know, maybe that's, you know, probably what you have. So there it wasn't, you know, our doctors for all the teams I played with were fantastic. I mean, they were all kind of like, this is, you know, becoming a serious issue in sports. You should probably, like, take this serious. You know, and I did. It was just, you know, which is why I stopped playing. But, you know, when you're younger, you're like, well, I can play in this game. No one's going to hit me, you know, that sort of thing. So
was it like cumulative, or did you take like one or two really bad?
Cumulative. Yeah, it was cumulative. I mean, I had a couple and, you know, maybe growing up skiing, and then maybe I had one in college that I remember being bad, because I remember one of our doctors was like, if you get another one, I was like, you know, we have to take you out of the game. And then, you know, a couple later on, and then my final year in indoor, I got hit in the head a ton. Like, one was really bad. I was looking the other way and someone cross-checked me from, like, literally the back of my head, and I was down for a little bit. And then it kind of, like, you know, this concussions, it's like there's a tipping point. Once you kind of get one that stick, from then on your threshold to get them becomes easier. So then by the end of the season, you know, small body checks that normally would do nothing would kind of ring your bell a little bit. So I kind of, like, in indoor, I was like, this is my last year playing lacrosse. I kind of knew it. I was like, I don't want to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, obviously. I'm not making enough money to do that. So I kind of was sensing that, but we had the World Games. I took a month off, played in the World Games, you know, played great. I was actually fine. But by the end, again, I had a couple of hits, and I was like, by the last game, I was like, this is the last game I'll ever play in.
You are this guy who loves snowboarding and launching off aerials. You play lacrosse. Everything you've said today, you talk about just going full speed. You talk about admiring the run and gun style of that Virginia Syracuse game and just going hard to the cage. And then there's the guy that had to retire because he was worried about his concussions at the top of his game. When you look back at sort of the debate about hitting in the sport, are people taking it too far, not letting their kids play football and stuff? Do you believe that all that is prudent? Or do you think it's overreacting?
I would say a little bit of both. For me personally, my situation, there were things that I did that I could have easily avoided, you know, it becoming worse. You know, and I don't blame lacrosse. You know, there were other things that, you know, that may have contributed. I don't even blame, like, you know, any sports I did when I was younger or even how I played. I mean, certainly didn't help that I just, you know, was somewhat relentless and being, I don't see lacrosse being like a concussion, a sport with tons of concussion issues. You know, if it happens, it needs to be handled right. But I don't see it being a rampant problem the way maybe you'd see football. I think football inherently is like just people smashing their heads against each other, which is just, I don't think anything good can come of that. So I think there's legitimate concern. You know, I think the way the sports are going is good, because really, from what I've learned in my situation, would have been significantly better if it's the second impact syndrome. I think that really does. I think our bodies are made to, like, handle one, you know, bad hit, you know, the head, you know, it can handle that. But when you, right at, like, 2 minutes after the head hit, if you're back and getting hit in the head again, and then another time, that's where, like, you start to see, like, some major issues. And I think the culture of all sports is changing for the better, because I think, you know, you look at all these guys that have major, I mean, they would literally play a full season with, like, a major concussion, which is, you know, not good. And I did that to a significantly lesser degree.
For kids listening or parents of young players, what advice do you have from your experience?
I would say, you know, let your kids play sports to parents. I mean, you just monitor it. And my advice is, you know, don't try to be a hero. Like, I think that's where we really can improve. When there's a significant hit where someone is dazed or, you know, potentially concussed, not just like any contact, but if the kid gets right back up, he's usually fine. But if he's down and there's an issue, he should not, you know, be playing the sport. sport again for a while until he sees someone and gets cleared to play. So I think I think that's my kind of, I guess, my preaching moment would be to monitor, and if a hit does happen and it looks like there's an issue, it's not the end of the world. But they can't go back and play.
All right, let's hit on Dom. Dom Starzia, Hall of Fame mm-hmm. coach. He's let go of Virginia after all those championships, a couple of rough years. The program is not without controversy. You know, you as a high profile Virginia lacrosse player, what was your reaction to get that news?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started hearing about it, I was obviously very upset. I didn't think it was warranted. You know, I was part of the group that tried to, you know, do their best to keep him there. I've kind of said this, but my loyalty is probably more towards Dom than even the university. I think he's the kind of the guy that, you know, that got me there, and he was, you know, over the 4 years was like a, you know, like a second father almost. So I think when it all started going down, I was interested in you know, in him, you know, over the program. So, you know, I was a little upset. I think, you know, one, that it was happening, and then how it was handled was even more upsetting. A guy, even more a Hall of Fame coach, he's, you know, he's got all these national championships and, you know, legendary, to be kind of like, you know, however it went down, I just, you know, that was weird and upsetting. And it was like, you kind of, you know, it just kind of goes to show where the sport is going.
Yeah, you kind of like to see him like Roy Simmons Jr., retires, and he's got that sort of grandfather of the Syracuse program.
I think everyone wanted that to be the situation. And you know, I will say that, you know, I think it's done now, and I think you know, the staff that's there now is great. I think it's great for the program, and I'm certainly excited about that. And you know, I've spoken to Dom, and I think he's in a good place, and I think he's able to stay down there and stay connected, and I think that's what everyone wants. I mean, I was hoping he could kind of go into a grandfather role and maybe even like an assistant AD position. I think there were rumors of that, which I think he would be phenomenal for. So very surprised that was not an option, but it was certainly upsetting.
All right, Jay, this has been awesome. I think that you got to go down as the most interesting guy, the Dos Equis most interesting man in lacrosse.
I'll take it. The honor's in mine, and you've obviously done amazing things for the sport. You know, setting the bar really high early on, and it was fun to be a part of it.